Before we get started, I want to thank Lori, because this is the last of, at least for this series. We're going to take a break till at least after Pesach. And I think this is, I don't know, the 18th or 19th class in this series on women and ritual from the source. I want to thank Lori and Ilana Sobrel-Safun, who taught four of the classes, and really a pleasure. And also for all your behind the scenes help and connections, and really it's very enjoyable having you, and it's learning with you, and like I mentioned before, you know, how you, the objectivity and how you approach the sources with such sensitivity, and then how to apply them in our modern life with being able to see the complexity and both sides of the issue. So I want to thank you for that, and it's thank you for teaching Torah to everybody, and Baruch Hashem, I can start, and enjoy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the Afsanya, for the opportunity. Thanks to the students for coming. And thank you, Rabbi Jay, for making this possible. And Bezrat Hashem, we will pick it up. It's just going to be a question of figuring out what's going to work best. Tov, welcome everybody tonight. I am delighted to be getting back to the Seder. And there are two elements of the Seder that I want to focus on. They're actually two things I love to teach. So one has to do with reclining. Okay, women in reclining. And women in reclining actually starts hitting on a lot of very fundamental questions of the changing status of women and how halacha may or may not recognize that. So that's the first topic. And then I want to move into talking about women in the Haggadah and the mitzvah of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, of telling over the story of leaving Egypt. So it's great stuff. Without further ado, I'm going to try to share the screen. Let's hope it goes well. So is, you know, so it's this moment of fear that maybe it won't work, but let's hope for the best. And we're off. Yes. Okay. Here we are. The first Mishnah of Arvei Pesachim, which is the 10th chapter of Masechet Pesachim, and it's the one that deals the most with Seder topics. It tells us what we have to do. Arvei Pesachim Samach Lemincha. It tells us what we have to do as we approach Lela Seder. And then it tells us that everyone's got to recline at the Seder. Afilu ani shebi Yisrael lo yochal ad sheyesev. Even a poor person in Israel is not permitted to eat at Lela Seder until that person is reclining. It's a really striking comment if you think about it. We're starting to talk about this festival of freedom. And effectively what we're saying is that we're all free, even those of us who are not necessarily sure where our next meal is coming from, who are not financially secure. All of us are included in the mitzvah of reclining, because not just anybody reclines. If we look at the Rambam, we get a little of a deeper sense of what it means in this context to recline. We've seen the parallel Mishnah last time, but the Rambam takes it and he connects the pieces together. B'chol dor v'dor, chayav adam leharot et atzmo ki'ilu hu be'atzmo yatza ata mishibud Mitzrayim. In each and every generation, every individual has to show himself. It's not just that we have to see ourselves this way, says the Rambam. We have to show ourselves this way. We have to be demonstrative, as though he himself, be'atzmo yatza ata, now, at this moment. If the question is, when did we leave Egypt? The answer is Lela Seder. Every year we leave Egypt again, Mishibud Mitzrayim, Shenemar, as it is written, Ve'otanu Hotzi Misham. God took us out of there, and we read us out of there not just as someone being quoted in Chumash, we read us out of there as us in the here and now, in every generation. Adavar Zet Siva Kadosh Baruch Hu B'Torah, V'Zacharta Ki Eved Hayita. And here is where God is reminding us we were avadim. We ourselves were bondsmen, klomar, ki ilu atab atzmecha hayita eved. We're supposed to have a sensibility at all times that we were bondsmen, v'yatzata lechirut v'nifteta, and we have become free, we have been redeemed. And here's the kicker. Look at the connection the Rambam says. We talked about this last time. If you really experience leaving Egypt as something that you yourself are doing now, the natural outgrowth of that is going to be praising God, but Rambam says something else. We have to show that we've left Egypt. Therefore, this is the next statement in Rambam. When someone eats on this night, I have to ask everybody to please mute. I can't scroll through all the things to see who's muted, but there's at least someone here who's unmuted. So please, please make sure you're muted. Thank you so much. Lefichach, shesoed adam b'layla hazeh, therefore, when someone dines on this night, on Seder night, sarich le'echol v'lishtot v'hum meisev derech chirut. He must eat and drink while reclining in the way of freedom. This Rashi is from the next line. Rambam is saying that the next thing, if we want to show, if we want to make it clear to ourselves and to others that we in fact have left Egypt, the way we do that is through reclining. Reclining is, as it were, it's the choreography of freedom. And you know, there's really something to it, because if our reclining is really the sense of eating expansively, relaxed, then effectively what we're saying is, this is not regular. We are really in a place, we have really gotten to a point of freedom. And that's an experience that we all share the sense of having been avadim. And even those of us who are not avadim right now, but are not fully secure, have to participate in that moment of freedom, in the choreography of freedom when we eat. And Rashi says something similar as well. Rashi talks about ad sheyetzev kederech ben chorim zecher lechirut, until a person reclines in the manner of a free person. And it's interesting, he says zecher lechirut. This reminds us of becoming free. Now the Talmud has a really interesting discussion of when during the Seder exactly we need to recline. Itmar, matzah, so it was said, matzah tzarich haseba, maror en tzarich haseba. Matzah requires reclining to eat. Maror doesn't require reclining to eat. This really makes sense based on what we've just said. If eating while reclining is a demonstration of freedom, matzah, which has an element of being the bread that we eat when we leave Egypt, can fit into the picture of reclining. And in fact, we must recline if we want matzah's symbolism as being part of our redemption to be realized. But maror, it's not appropriate to recline when we eat maror, because maror's symbolism is all about bitterness. And the bitterness is the moment of slavery by maroru et chayehem. The bitterness is not the moment of freedom, of reclining. So it's when we eat matzah that we recline. When we eat maror, we don't accept in the context of korach, when it's alongside the matzah, as it were, as part of the, where's the beef, Pesach sandwich, which is missing the Pesach nowadays. Next part, what about the wine? Yain, itmar mishmed Rav Nachman tzarich haseba, v'itmar mishmed Rav Nachman en tzarich haseba. We have two competing traditions, both of them in the name of Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak. The first one says, yes, absolutely. When you have wine, I'm going to ask you, someone just highlighted, I'm going to ask you to let me be the annotator, okay? But let me just see if I can clear that. Thanks so much. Let me get my mouse back. Okay, so Rav Nachman there are two reported traditions in the name of Rav Nachman. The first is that when you drink wine on Leila Seder, you must recline. And the second is that you don't need to recline. So which is it? Lo pligi. In fact, it's not a conflict. Ha batarti kasi kamai, ha batarti kasi batrai. There are two sets of two cups. The first two before the meal, the second two after the meal. We have the cup. We talked about this last time when we talked about the four cups, right? We have kiddush, we have magen, we have birkat hamazon, we have challah. And the meal is in the middle, two and two. And what we're being told is there are two of these for which we need to recline, and there are two of these for which we don't need to recline. Well, which is which? Amri la l'hai gisa, amri la l'hai gisa. There are those who say it one way, and there are those who say it another. What are the two ways? First step. Tre kase kam amri la l'hai gisa. Here's the first way to do it. Tre kase kamai ba'u seba. The first two cups are the ones that require a seba. Why? Because this is the moment when our freedom begins. Again, this is exactly what Rambam was saying. If it's Heseba itself that demonstrates that we are now leaving Egypt, that process of leaving Egypt is happening in the beginning of the Seder with Magid. Magid is when we're getting going with the story of leaving Egypt. It's when we're telling the tale. That's when we should be reclining. But on this version, the last two cups don't require a seba. What was? We're done. We told the story already. We had our meal, and now we're just finishing up with halal, etc. That's perspective number one. And then perspective number two, Vamri Lala Haigis, and they said this way, Adarabba, on the contrary, Trekasi Batrai Bao Hiseba. It's the last two cups that require a seba. Why? Haishata dikahavya cherut. Because this is the moment where we have been freed. It's almost like you could ask what's more important, the process or the result. If we say the first two cups are when you need it, we're saying it's that process of becoming free. That needs to save it. If we're saying it's the last two cups when we need it, we're saying now that we are free, when it's been complete, that's the moment when we can have Haseba. Chirut has been fully realized. I ban this view. Because we're still about to say, we're still saying Avadim Ayinu is part of Magid. As long as we have not told fully of leaving Egypt, we are not fully free. So what can we do? We have these two different versions of what's appropriate behavior with leaning and wine at the Seder. And the answer is, Hashta d'itmar hachi, d'itmar hachi. Now that we've said it this way, and we've said it that way, idi v'idi ba'oseba, you know what? We're going to lean for all of the cups. In effect, what we're saying is that both things matter, the process and the result. We're leaning for that moment of beginning to leave Egypt. Even though we're still avadim hayinu, redemption's right around the corner. And we're leaning for that moment of knowing that we are praising God and thanking him because we just left and we are now fully free. Okay, all of this is beautiful. None of it sounds particularly gendered. Where do women come in? And here's where things get a little more interesting. Isha etzel ba'ala lo ba'e heseba. A woman eating at Leila Seder in the presence of her husband does not require reclining. Ve'im isha chashuva hi tzricha heseba. But if she is an important woman, she needs to recline. Now we're going to have to figure out what it is about a woman eating with her husband that would affect whether or not she should recline. We could almost ask that would affect how she's demonstrating her freedom. Because we know, for example, we said last time, we talked about women being obligated in the four cups of Hannah Yubel Toanes. Women are included in the miracle. Therefore, women are free at Leil HaSeder. So what is going on with the husband being there that changes things? And we also need to understand what is an Isha Chashuva? And what makes her different so that she has to recline? And there are a couple more examples in the Talmud that are helpful for giving us some context to try and understand this. Men in Tel Aviv by Seba, a son with his father does in fact need to recline. Ibai Elohu, they ask the following conceptual question. What about a Talmid etzel Rabo? Talmid etzel Rabo Mai. What about a student and teacher? You'll notice that these relationships that we're seeing, these second two are certainly hierarchical. We're going to have to ask ourselves what the picture here is of marriage. But the picture of a father and son, right? The son is in some level in a lower down, we could say, in hierarchy with the father and a student and a teacher. And what's going on with the student and the teacher? Tashma, Amar Abaye, Ki Avinam Be'mar, Zaginan Abirke Dadadi. Abaye says, when we went to master's house, we would lean on each other's legs. So you have to imagine a lot of, this is not in a corona situation. You have a lot of students sitting very close together. They can't all possibly lean on their chairs. So they're leaning one on each other's legs, kind of almost like dominoes lined up, reclining on each other. But that certainly suggests that a student does in fact recline in the presence of the teacher. Ki atinan lebe Rav Yosef, Amarlan, however, when we reached the home of Rav Yosef and we had Seder there, he said to us, lo tzrichatu. You don't need to do that. Mora rabcha kemora shamayim. In fact, the awe of your master is like the awe of heaven. So there's something about being in a situation where you would be in awe of someone that would constrain reclining. That makes some sense. Imagine yourself on a very comfortable couch in your home with your feet up. There are people who would come perhaps through the door of your household and you would remain reclining somewhat in the way we might recline more comfortably with your feet up. And there are certain people that if they would come through the door, you would immediately jump to your feet or put your feet down and sit up straight. there's a symbolism here. And what's not entirely clear to us yet is how the woman fits in and what her husband has to do with it. So that's what we have to try to, what we have to tease out. There's something else that I want to point out, and this is very, very important. In the entire, throughout this passage, no one has been saying that there's a situation where reclining is prohibited. The question has been throughout, when is reclining required? So for example, when they talk, even Rav Yosef here, when he's saying that a student with the teacher, he says, lo tzrichatu, you didn't have to recline. He's not saying you couldn't recline. That's important. If we understand that reclining is a mitzvah, then for example, it's not clear that we've actually satisfied the obligation of eating matzah properly if we haven't reclined. It's part and parcel. Eating the food in Leil HaSeder is not just an act of eating. Eating the food at Leil HaSeder is fully integrated with telling the story. And part of that story and that experience of leaving Egypt, as we said in Rambam, we just saw it, is in fact reclining. So it's important for us to understand when it's obligatory and when it's not. Okay, let's look at some of these opinions. We're going to start with the Sheilka de Rav Chai Gaon. By the way, I see that there's some questions on chat. Bezrat Hashem, at the end of class, I'll take all the chat questions together. Okay, Sheilka de Rav Chai Gaon. He says, Isha eina tzricha yaseba. A woman doesn't need to recline. Mai taima? What's the reason? Lav derchan denashe lamaska. It is just not the way of women to lean themselves over. But if a woman is important, she needs to. So he's saying something. He's not giving us a lot of information. Why? He's saying it's not what's done in the Metzias, in terms of the actualia. Reclining was a way that one ate. It was a way that free people, that even aristocrats, would eat. Women were not necessarily historically reclining. And if that's the case, that women didn't historically recline, then it wouldn't bear the same significance for a woman to recline as it would for a man to recline. You wouldn't have the same set of meanings around the action necessarily. And that's what he's suggesting. And yet an important woman, and by the way, I think this is correct in historical records. We looked into this a little bit when we were writing for this for derachah.org. And in fact, there was something to this, that the women who were more aristocratic or more independently wealthy or at a different level of status, those women might in some situations recline. But on the whole, women did not recline. So one way of understanding this is that we're not obligating a woman in a mitzvah to recline, which reflects a certain type of freedom and as a whole world of meanings, when for most women, this wasn't the world of meanings. Being a free woman did not necessarily mean that you reclined unless you were uniquely important. Okay, that's one possibility. Possibility number two, Rashbam. Isha einat tzricha eseba, a woman need not recline. Mipnei mat ba'alau kufalo. Well, Rashbam, you remember, is a Pashtun. He really reads things in context, and this is good reading in context. He's saying, look, what were the things we saw? We saw discussion of a child with the father. We saw discussion of a student with a rabbi. So too, a woman with her husband. He's suggesting it's a sort of hierarchical relationship. The woman is in some sense in awe of her husband. She's submissive to him. It's not reasonable to expect someone to be able to recline when they're feeling that they are in a situation where they have to show great respect. They have to stand at attention, as it were. So that's the Rashbam. So possibility number one was, this just isn't what women did. Possibility number two is, this wouldn't be a reasonable thing to expect a woman to do in the presence of her husband. It's not how those interactions worked. Possibility number three, Bechira Meiri. She'en cherut le'isha etzel bala, that a woman doesn't fully feel freedom when she eats with her husband. But if she's an important woman, she needs to recline. Because in that case, there's no aspect of servility in her marital relationship. This I personally find fascinating. Meiri is effectively saying, if I understand him correctly, that the Talmud is picturing most marriages as having some element of the woman being subject to her husband, at least in that era. And he's saying that the discussion of the Isha Chashuva is making room for the idea that not every marriage worked that way, even in the Talmudic era. And that the hallmark of an Isha Chashuva is that her marriage does not include servility. that sense of awe is not the overarching emotional framework of that marital relationship. And the suggestion is that when the marital relationship is one of greater parity, then it would in fact be reasonable to say that a woman must recline. Because the reason you would say a woman wouldn't have to recline again is if for some reason she feels she has to stay at standard attention, as it were, for her husband, in awe of her husband. If that's not the way they interact, she's an isha chashuva, then it is a reasonable expectation for her to be able to recline. Okay, let's move forward a little bit and let's look at Mordechai. Mordechai says like this, medieval Ashkenaz, he says, "Tekulu nashim didan chashuvot ninhu." He says, all of our women, in fact, are chashuvot. All of our women are important women. He's saying, Mr. Artu, does someone, could I ask you to clear your annotations, please? I can do it myself, but it's just going to take me a moment and distract from the shir. All right, Beseder, I'll clear them up. Okay, so what the Mordechai is saying is that all women in his day already, and this is hundreds of years ago, all women are included in this framework of being chashuvot. And Rav Moshe Feinstein actually has a really interesting comment about this. Let me find it. I'm going to skip the source and then come back to one more source that's really interesting on this point. Rav Moshe Feinstein says like this, Shehikiru b'meshach hazman. You try to understand what happened that leading up to the Mordechai, suddenly all the women became important. Shehikiru b'meshach hazman, they came to understand as time went by, she'enla inshi b'malit ga'ot neged nishotein, that men really had nothing to lord over their wives. V'ana shehikiru tzorach gadol sheyesh la inshi behen. And the women saw what need their husbands had for them. There was sort of a greater recognition of a woman's importance. V'mi'ut chashuvot she'yu b'chol hazmanim hayu nashim ke'elu. And in all the generations, there was always at least some minority, but some important minority of women whose husbands understood their significance. Just as a woman, generally speaking, understands her husband's significance to her. V'ikiru shegam ba'alehen yod'in ze de'seba ha'en ze devar chadash. I'm sorry. And they understood that that their husbands knew this thing. Excuse me one second. I just want to. They understood that Heseba is not something new. It's not some new innovation to say that women would be reclining. Rather, Tiknu demaseh hilato shtiato shechiva Torah lakira chirut vagula. Rather, it's an ancient enactment in recognition of our freedom and our redemption when we eat. Yebe open shiater yesh po lakira chirut, that should be more recognizable. And that is appropriate depending on your station in life. So what the Igra Moshe is saying is he's saying something changed. He's saying, yeah, something really changed in how the marital relationship was being recognized. Now, it's very important. He's not saying that something changed in terms of the Torah's vision of the marital relationship. He's not saying that there was some brand new, that there was some turning point either. He's saying it was always the case that there were marriages that worked in this fashion, but that became increasingly understood even by the Mordechai's time. There's one more source on Nashim Chashuvot and the important woman that I want to look at with you. And then I want to kind of like summarize this part before we move on to talk about Magid at the Seder. And I think I want to talk about also kind of there are broader implications to what we're reading, I think, in terms of women in Halacha in general. Okay, now this is Rabbeinu Manoach of 13th century Provence. V'imisha chashuvahi, and if she's an important woman, klomar, she'ain la ba'al. So he's going to give a few different explanations. First explanation for important woman, she doesn't have a husband. Higveret habayit. She runs the house herself. Tzricha seba. In that case, she would need to recline. So one possibility is that the Isha Chashuva, it said that a woman with her husband, right, in the Talmud, it said a woman etzel ba'ala doesn't need to recline. So then a woman who does need to recline, that important woman, must by definition be a woman without a husband. That is interesting. And historically, we know there were a lot of women who, in particular in widowhood, became kind of pronounced in their importance in the community. Inami, alternatively, shehi chashuva bifnei Hashem. Alternatively, this isn't a social definition of someone's importance. She's important in the eyes of God. Why? Yireat Hashem, because she fears heaven. Bat gedolei ador, you know, she could be the daughter of great scholars of her time. Kolelet shivchei eshet chayil. She's someone who would merit the type of praise that you give to the woman of valor. V'zot ha'isha. Im nimnam tziyuta, afa pi sheyesh labal, tzricha eseba. And this woman, he's playing, doing a play on words with Eshet Chayil, right? We begin Eshet Chayil with Eshet Chayil miyimsa, a woman of valor who you can find. So he's saying, even if this woman might sometimes be hard to find, well, you know, when you find her, whether or not she's got a husband, she'd better recline. Inami, alternatively, yesh lefaresh, we can explain it like this. Maybe the Talmud was trying to be very realistic and help women get the Seder on the table. You know, how would it be fair to expect a woman to recline when she's going to be up every 2 seconds and helping around? The hanato, because of the preparations of the food and being so preoccupied with it, petrua meseba, that's why they exempted her from that. So we assume that women are also exempt from positive time bound commandments because women are busy. Aval, but an isha chashuva sheyesh la avadim u'shvachot hatordim b'nyanei ha'machal. But an important woman, here he thinks important means wealthy, who's got other people looking out for her. He yoshev b'katedra, and she can basically sit while other people are taking care of things. She must recline. Rabbeinu Manoach is giving us three different potential explanations of what an isha chashuva is. The first explanation, a woman who's the head of her own household. There's no husband there to affect her comportment. Second explanation, or let's jump to the third, right? The third explanation was a wealthy woman. She's a wealthy woman, so there's no practical constraint on her being able to fully recline and take part of the meal at leisure with everyone else. The second explanation is the one that I confess grabs me the most. She's significant in the eyes of God. She is spiritually an important person. And her spiritual importance is such that it's a given that she must recline at the Seder. What I think is particularly important about these words, aside from just the idea that even in Talmudic times, there's a recognition, even in Talmudic times, that not all women are in the same boat. On the one hand, there's a recognition that in those times, there are women who are in a subservient position, perhaps, depending on how we read this passage, maybe financially, maybe in terms of how the marriage works. And on the other hand, there's a recognition, even in Talmudic times, that not all women are subservient, or not all women are in difficult financial straits, or not all women lack their own rich spiritual lives. That's there too already then. I think it's particularly important now because sometimes there are, there's a question often about how we relate to halachot, taking into account this changing status of women. And in our world where there's so many more opportunities available to women in every field, in every way, and thank God there's so many things that can help us so that housework doesn't just fall on a woman. Men are more involved in that as well, but also we have our machines. Yeah, you don't need me to tell you all this. But the question is, how does halacha react to that? So sometimes the response that you'll hear sometimes is, things are so changed that at this point, women are a completely different category that Chazal knew nothing about. Chazal could never envision women being in a category where they're spiritually on a par with men or where they're have their own unique importance. And that's not really true in other contexts as well. But here, I think it comes out very strongly that's not the case. It's very clear from this passage that there's a concept in Chazal already that perhaps it was a minority of women of their time. But there's a concept of the Isha Chashuva. There's an idea that regardless of the situation that many women might find themselves in, there are women who have already at that time an important status. Now, the other interesting thing is it can affect a halacha. And the question is, and this is what's tricky, what halachas would it affect and what halachas would it not affect? Given that they know what the category is, the fact that they don't apply it so widely in other cases suggests to us that women's exemptions from other mitzvot is not necessarily, you know, people want to say sometimes it's purely sociological. I think this example of Haseba makes that a lot harder to say. I think it's hard to say it's purely sociological when we see that there's a case where a halacha is tied, perhaps, in some level to sociology. We see that, in fact, here the Hazala recognizing that there are other categories of women. And were other things, other exemptions sociological, we would expect to see a discussion of the Isha Chashuva keeping Mitzvot Aseh Shezman Grama or something like that. And we don't see it. So I think this is a really important set of texts for understanding the Chazal recognize that a sociological reality can shift and that women's inherent spiritual potential or even potential to fulfill mitzvot is much broader than just a sociological factor, and that there's more going on than that. There's a lot more to our traditions than just sociological claims. So I think that's very important. I also think that it's really meaningful. I can say for myself, it's very meaningful to, I do lean at the Seder. And it's very meaningful for me personally to lean at the Seder because when I do, I have Rabbeinu Manoach in mind. I feel blessed, like Rav Moshe Feinstein said, I feel blessed that I'm in a marriage where I do feel that both my husband and I recognize our mutual importance to each other. But then there's this added factor of, well, I'm an Isha Chashuva, Bezrat Hashem, or at least I'm striving to be an Isha Chashuva spiritually as well in my relationship to God. And one of the ways I'm reflecting that is by fully embracing the choreography of freedom. Now, that being said, there are many women who have a custom not to recline. And that's okay. There's precedent for that. If we look in the Shulchan Aruch, Isha Einat Tzricha Seba Elim Keni Chashuva. So the Shulchan Aruch says a woman is not obligated to recline, just like we see on the Gemara, unless she's considered to be in this category of important woman. And then the Rama comes in and he says, like the Mordechai, V'chol anashim shelanu mikrei chashuvot, but all women, all of our women are considered chashuvot, i.e., sounds like he's saying Ashkenazi women at least should be reclining. Achlona gulasiv, but it's not customary. He's saying on the one hand, the women of our time are chashuvot, on the other hand, it's not the custom. Now he has to try to explain the custom. How can it be? The Talmud said straight out, and the Chaber said straight out, a woman is considered to be an important woman. She should be reclining. How can it be that women are all important, but they're not reclining? And his answer is, he's relying on the Ravia. The Ravia said, "Vizman hazeh she'en regilot b'nei chorin le'sev yishev k'darko." The Ravia doesn't just say this about women. He says it about everybody. The Ravia says, look, reclining nowadays at a meal doesn't mean what reclining meant at a meal in the days of Chazal. Once reclining doesn't have the same meaning, then we're not really achieving that choreography of chirut the way we once did. And once it's no longer the mitziut, once it's no longer that symbolic, no one needs to do it. So the Rama is comfortable in relying on the Ravia for women to explain why women of his day are not reclining. So that being said, if a woman has a custom, her mother, her grandmother, it's a strong custom in her family not to recline, and certainly that custom can be respected. It's not clear to me that custom has to mean that she can't recline. That's something she could discuss with halachic authority if she wants to. But I don't see why, even what we saw in the Talmud, the fact that someone didn't recline didn't suggest that she couldn't recline at any stage of the discussion there. And then there's a lot to be said for saying that women, certainly women who don't have a custom to go on, there's a lot to be said that a woman could recline if it is meaningful to her. The Kaf HaChaim says that I mean hag ben asfaradim lesev, the Sephardi custom is for everyone to recline. Nirata gam bekila takdoshim ashkenazim shenagu anashim shlo lesev hamachmira lesev tavola bracha. He says, look, even among Ashkenazi women where the custom was not to recline, and it's interesting he's saying that Sephardi women have the custom to recline, right? Because what we saw from the Shulchan Aruch didn't make that clear. But he's saying even among Ashkenazi women where the custom is not to recline, he thinks it would be a chumrah to recline. He doesn't think it's objectionable if there's a custom not to recline, to recline. He thinks it's a chumrah to recline. He thinks it's a good thing. He thinks not reclining is a kula. Because if you really think that the way that you fulfill the mitzvahs is they're tied together, and that hesebe is part of how, certainly it's part of how a man fulfills the mitzvah, let's say, of eating matzah. That's what we saw in the Gemara, right? And it's part of how he fulfills the mitzvah of the Arba Kosot. Then if a woman had the opportunity to do that, you can make a very strong case for it. Okay, next step. And again, I'll take some questions at the end. Telling the story. What about Magid? We have to start with the mitzvah. V'gadta levincha b'yomahu le'mor. And you say to your child in that day, you'll tell your child in that day, saying, Bavur zeh asa Hashem li b'tzeitim Mitzrayim. I'm doing all of this on account of what God did for me when I left Egypt. It's real, it's for me, I'm here. And we know the Rabban Gamliel, the core of Magid, is talking about, and I believe he talked about this with Rav Adler. Certainly if you were talking about the four questions, I'm not sure. Anyway, the Pesach, Matzah, and Maror are necessary for talking about things. Now, the interesting thing is that Rabban Gamliel says, whoever doesn't say these three things on Pesach hasn't discharged his obligation. And the question is, which obligation are we talking about? Now, usually the easiest reading is, well, you have to say these things you have to talk about Pesach, Matzah, and Maror in order to fulfill the obligation of Magid, in order to fulfill the obligation of telling the story. Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, that's the easiest read. What's fascinating is that the Ramban says differently. The Ramban suggests that in fact, what he means is that he hasn't fulfilled his mitzvah of eating. Part of the mitzvah of eating matzah is telling the story. We tell it through our choreography as well. But part of the mitzvah of eating matzah is telling the story. It's not just a ritual act of obligatory eating. The symbolic meaning is embedded in the mitzvah to the extent that if I didn't talk about what the matzah is, I haven't really eaten matzah. That's what the Ramban is suggesting. And that works very nicely with a drasha in the Gemara that says lechem oni. Why is matzah called lechem oni? Because it's that which is literally the bread of affliction, right? Like the word ani. That's how we started, right? Affliction. And even the afflicted of nowadays is reclining. Well, lechem oni. Lechem she'onin alav dvarim harbe. It's the bread that we say a lot of things over. Matzah is not just there for eating, but we talk about matzah zeh, we talk about bizman shematzah maror munachim lefanecha. There's something about telling the story when it's out there, it's connected. Now that's going to be very important for considering what the obligation of women is in telling the story at Lela Seder. Because last week what we discussed was how women are fully obligated on a Torah level in eating matzah. We said, women are obligated, are prohibited from eating chametz. There's a hekesh, there's this parallelism between not eating chametz and eating matzah. Therefore, women are obligated to eat matzah, even though we might have thought it was positive time bound commandment. Okay, so what does that mean in terms of saying magid? It would suggest, perhaps, that women would be obligated. We see that suggestion. A little later on, we'll look at it in the Rav Moshe Feinstein, but I want to look at some other suggestions as well. There's also an idea we talked about when we talked about the four cups of Afhena Yubel Tornes. Here we have the Mechaber. Gam anashim chayavot ba'arba kosot. Women are obligated in the four cups. Uvchol mitzvot hanoagot ba'oto alayla. And in all of the mitzvot that we do that night. Now remember, last time when we were talking about the cups, we said that we saw the opinion of Tosfot, that women are obligated not just in drinking the four cups, but also in reciting Hallel. And Tosfot said that women are obligated to recite Hallel at Leila Seder because the four cups and Hallel are intertwined, right? We have a cup that's over Hallel. Hallel and Hodah, it's all one big thing of proclaiming and giving thanks for God's miracles. Therefore, women are fully obligated in Hallel, according to Tosfot, on Leila Seder. And now, one might argue something similar when it comes to Magid. We also recite Magid over a cup. Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim is also connected to a cup. If the fact that we're obligated, that women are obligated in the four cups by virtue of inclusion in the miracle, Afhena Yubeo Toanes, is a function, it's going to lead us to understand that women are also obligated in hollow, because one of our cups is for hollow, then perhaps it could also give us to understand that women are obligated in magid. And that seems to be, at least what Beit Yosef says, echad anashim v'echad nashim chayavim behem. Nashim chayavot b'dalet kusot, she'af hen hayu b'oto anes. Women are obligated in the four cups because of being included in the miracle. U'mita'am zeh, and for this reason, sarich lomar, one must say, she'hen chayavot b'chol mitzvot hanoagot b'oto alayla. That they're obligated in all the mitzvot of that night. And Mishnah Berurah says, what does that mean? That includes Haggadah, that includes Magid. Okay, so we can say that women are obligated by virtue of Afhena Yuba Otoanes in Magidit Lela Seder. There's only one little tricky part here. And that is, you might recall, as we discussed, when we discussed Megillah reading, that Afhena Yuba Otoanes, it's not clear that it always obligates on a Torah level. Are women obligated rabbinically or biblically in this mitzvah? The Sefer HaChinuch says women are obligated biblically. But he doesn't explain why. He talks about the mitzvah of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, and he says, "Noheget bizcharim v'nekevot." This is performed. It's obligatory. It applies to men and to women. According to Sefer HaChinuch, women are obligated, in fact, in a Torah level in Magid. Now, it might be that he does say it's because of Avhen Hayu Be'otones, and he just thinks that Avhen Hayu Be'otones can obligate you on a Torah level mitzvah, which is a minority opinion. It's possible. But it's possible that he's thinking something else. Now, the Rambam, just so you know, the Rambam's position is a little more tricky. We don't really know 100% what the Rambam held in this regard. On the one hand, he talks about mitzvot that women are obligated in, even though their positive time-bound commandments. And he includes in these obligations achilat matzah, eating matzah and lila seder, and achilat pesach and shchita, the pesach, we talked about that last time, and simchas yom tov. These are all things women are obligated in. He didn't mention here Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. So when he's talking about positive time-bound commandments in which women are obligated, he neglected to mention Magid. Suggests that maybe women aren't obligated, at least not on a Torah level. On the other hand, when he talks in Sefer Mitzvot, when he talks about mitzvot that women are exempt from, he doesn't list Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. See the problem? On the one hand, when he talks about things that women are obligated in, he didn't list Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. On the other hand, when he talks about things that women are exempt from, mitzvot or right that women are exempt from, he also doesn't list Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. It's not really clear what the Rambam held. We don't know for sure. We can guess, but we don't know for sure. The Igros Moshe kind of sums up and says, "Yimisha yechola loti ishi dechovat hagada." Now, why does he ask this question? He's asking the question if a woman can discharge a man's obligation in reciting the Haggadah. And this is a relevant question because it is to be able to discharge someone else's obligation requires being obligated on the same level. So if a woman is obligated on a Torah level in Magid, then she can discharge a man's obligation in Magid, in theory. If a woman's obligated on a rabbinic level, she wouldn't be able to. I said in theory, and this is important because it's actually an interesting question about what goes on in Lila Seder. Different people have different customs in this regard. Does one person recite the entire Seder for everybody, where everyone is discharging the obligation through perhaps a Shomea Ke'oneh, hearing is akin to answering or is akin to saying? Or does each person actually have to say the entire Seder for themselves? Different people have different customs in this regard, but this is important. For example, if you have a family that's going around in Magid, taking turns with people leading, which some people do, it would be really important to know if women are obligated on the level or if men have to say the things under their breath when a woman recites them. And his answer is, it says it's clear, woman's obligated in saying the Haggadah. Because women are obligated in all of the obligations of Pesach. What he's saying is, it's not a fin hayu be'otones, It's the obligation in matzah. It's the prohibition of chametz, and it's the obligation in matzah. That intertwining of matzah with magid is enough to mean that women are fully obligated in magid on the same level as men. And why should the four cups be different? Four cups would be different because maybe the sages want to give women a break because it's only rabbinic. He comes up with the reason. But ultimately, the Igros Moshe is suggesting that women's obligation in Magid is 100% on the same level as men, on a Torah level, like Sefer HaChinuch said before him. And he's saying that the basis for that is, in fact, women's obligation in Lechemoni, in Matzah. Okay, so just to conclude things up, also Rav Avadya Yosef as well. He also says that this is the case. There's one last thing I want to touch on before we go and talk about questions, and that's getting into practical nitty-gritty. It's nice to say that women are obligated in basically we've said women are obligated in everything at Lilith Seder. Last time we talked about matzah, we talked about maror, we talked about the four cups, we talked about challah. Tonight we've talked about reclining, and we've talked about magid, which is really our central mitzvah in a lot of ways. Not to mention, of course, the Pesach. But this can, in practice, be really hard to do. It kind of circles us back to when we're talking about the Isha Chashuva. So perhaps nowadays all women are important, but even we important women often find ourselves with an awful lot of responsibilities on Lilith Seder that can make it very difficult to sit through the whole Seder. There can be little children breastfeeding. If a woman is breastfeeding and her child needs to eat or be put to sleep, there's any number of situations, sometimes with someone elderly. Now, it's not just women, by the way. Sometimes men have difficulty hearing the entire Seder as well. But it frequently happens that whether it's a caretaking role or it's helping to make sure that everything is prepared, it frequently happens that a woman might be challenged to sit at the Seder table for the entire Seder. And the question becomes, we've talked about all the other mitzvot. She's obligated. There's nothing to do. She's going to have the matzah. She's going to have the maror. She's going to have to say hello. Within Magid, what are the things that absolutely must be said in order to discharge the obligation, which, as we've said, according to Sefer HaChinuch, at least, is on a deraita level. Mechaber says a woman is certainly obligated. There are those who say it might be rabbinic, but on the whole, it looks like we're saying it's on a Torah level, and that's the Pesach nowadays of, very recently, Igros Moshe and Rav Avadya Yosef both came down on the side that women are obligated on a Torah level. What in practice is kind of the minimum kernel of Magid that a woman should be sure to hear? Now, some of this is obvious and some of it's not. The Chayei Adam lays it out. Gam nashim chayavot b'chol ha-mitzvot v'amirat ha-agadah. Women are fully obligated in all the mitzvot of Lilith Seder and in saying the Agada. V'lachen, and therefore, chiyuv shegam ha-mesharetet teshev etzal shulchan tishma kol ha-agadah. Even a serving woman, this reminds us of how we started, right? Afilu ani shebisrael yochal ad shisiv. Everybody is included in this. It doesn't matter if she's the woman of the home or if she's a serving woman. We're not talking about reclining now. We're talking about magid. Everyone's got to tell the story and hear the story. Vim tzricha letzeit lachutz levashel. What if she has to go cook? Al kol panim mechuyevet lishmoa kiddush. She must hear kiddush. Then when we get to Magid, the three things, Pesach, Matzah, Maror, Tichnos, V'tishma. She's got to hear them. Ad lachar shtiat kosbet. So she's got to hear from Pesach, Matzah, Maror through drinking the kosa Magid. Sherei mishalo amar gimel dvarim halalu lo yatsa. She is not going to fulfill her obligations if she hasn't had those three things. Menoagin, and it's also practice, shegam korin otam. We also call them Shetishma ha'eser makot sheviyal mitzrayim, that they hear the 10 plagues that were brought on Egypt. Kedei la'gid lahem kama nisim asa kadosh baruch hu bishvil Yisrael, so that they know how many miracles God has done to Israel. This last part I found particularly fascinating. The first part I understand from Rabban Gamliel to the end of Magid is absolutely critical for a woman to hear to hear the pieces. Actually, if you want a very practical list, I'll put the link on the chat in a second. In our article on this on derachad.org, we lay out a very practical list of what really needs to be said during Magid and what can be skipped over, because we have different editions that have come over the years. But But I really find it fascinating that in addition to kind of that mitzvah look that says she's got to hear the three things or else she hasn't observed, fulfilled the obligations, there's also the sense of she's got to hear about the plagues. I mean, she has to get what a miracle this was. There's the considerations here are not just pure mitzvah considerations, right? The consideration here is also we have to make sure that there's that moment where every single individual who's involved with all a Seder is tapping into what God did. Everyone is really feeling that we left Egypt, and leaving Egypt isn't just the sense of freedom. It's a sense of having been freed by God for the purpose of serving God. So we got to bring in the plagues. So, okay, I'm going to go and look at what you wrote. Let me just put in this link before I forget. So that you can all, you know what, I'm actually going to link you to, it's a page we have on our site with all of our Pesach materials, including, by the way, a really great guide to the Erev, to Shabbos being Erev Pesach. So you can, this page has a lot of things, the stuff that I've been teaching from tonight, this in particular, a list of tips for how to help maximize your ability to hear as much of the Seder as possible, and also the minimum that needs to be said for Magid, or in an article called Pesach, this are called Seder 2. Okay, let's see what we've got here on the chat. Noah Weinberger, I'm so glad that you learned yesterday's daf. So your daf yomi, Ellen's also doing the daf yomi. Yeah, it's unbelievably gavaldic that daf yomi came out to Arvei Pesachim now. It's just great. Who is serving the meal? Perhaps an Isha Chashuva is someone else serving. Ah, so you predicted, right? We saw exactly that in Rabbeinu Manoach. Okay. Noah Weinberger, maybe the wife of Reish Galuta, the wife of right. So that's the interesting thing. You know, there's the Isha Chashuva who he talks about, you know, maybe it's the daughter of the Gedolei Ador, but there's something about this. It just captures my imagination when he talks about the Isha Chashuva being the Yiret Shemayim Eshes Chayil, right? She didn't necessarily have the father as a Talmid Chacham. Maybe she did. She's not necessarily wealthy, but there's this, the story of her serving God on the Seder night is prominent. How much of this changed Mordechai, Igrot Moshe's internal developments, and how much reflects external development in society? I think you've got to say that they're interacting. I don't think there's any way around it. The truth is, there's a really interesting book by Professor Avram Grossman. It's called Chassidot Mordot. In English, I think it's been translated called Pious and Rebellious. It talks about women in medieval Ashkenaz. And one of the things he does is he compares the status of women in Ashkenaz and in Sfard in at different stages. And he talks about how women's having a more prominent role in commerce would affect actually some of the roles they would take on in religious life. It's not a new thing or a new idea that women's religious lives would be affected by women's lives in other respects. The thing that's really interesting here is the way the interaction works. The fact that there's this like particular precedent for the interaction, that this category is recognized, and then at the same time that Chazal are not applying this category right and left, which suggests that a lot of our exemptions are not just based on sociology, but are in fact based on a different type of tradition. So it's a lot to think about. I don't have answers to all these questions. Working on it. Makes sense to apply here since Seder is about how one sees oneself as free. Interesting. So Carol's, if I understand you right, Carol, you're saying that in particular on Lila Seder, our the way we understand ourselves is going to have to interact with how we're experiencing Seder. Is that what you're getting
right,
at?
In contrast to Devarim, I'm forgetting the thing, but you know, the temporary, the positive time-bound mitzvot here, you know, in general, this is a particular kind of case.
It's a moment. We're embodying a role, and it's supposed to be, and that's why does Rambam bring in the Zachartaki Eved Ayita? That pasuk isn't even talking there about Lila Seder at all. What he's saying is we're supposed to be building this, we were a bondsman consciousness year through, year by year. That's what we're constructing at the Seder. We're constructing our self-image. Our self-image has to connect to how we're constructing it. But we are becoming these people who know what it was to be enslaved and who know what it is to be free and who know what it is to see what God did. Is a reclining even close to what was originally? Depends on how you do it nowadays. There are people, I think, who really, they used to have like TV tables and couches, almost like sedan-like things. It was much more elaborate. One thing I will say, and this is important, you know, do try to set up your chair. If you set up your chair, I'm actually a lefty, so it kind of, that's its own halachic discussion. But you want to set up your chair so that you're supposed to lean to the left. That's part of the Gemara that we skipped. You want to set up your chair that you can't see it on the camera. I'm trying to do this so you can see. If you turn your chair to the side, which is what I've done, you turn your chair to the side and then you can really lean more comfortably. So it's something you can think about. But yeah, most of us are not doing reclining quite in the classic Greco-Roman manner. So you never know. This might be the year to try it. Okay. Right. So that's the point. Exactly. So when you try to do it like sitting like this, I think in particular, it can be cramped. And the idea is you want to try to find a way to do it that's more comfortable. Okay. And the truth is that we say, so Susanna, actually, we do say that lefties still recline left because there's an opinion in the Gemara that it would actually be dangerous to recline to your right side. Okay. And those of us who follow Ravia, okay, if you follow Ravia, then you're not reclining, and there you go. And at least you can appreciate what it's about, even if it's not. And perhaps, and this is interesting, so if you follow Ravia, in effect, what you're saying is, well, reclining doesn't have that symbolic meaning to me now. So I would kind of challenge you, if you're following Ravia, so what would? If you're not going to recline at Lila Seder, because you're saying that doesn't mean that I'm eating in Chayrut now, what are you going to do? So that you have that consciousness as you're eating of chayrut. Now, by the way, men, generally speaking, do not rely on the ravia. It's specifically women are, you know, it's a limud schud of the Ramah that women can rely on the ravia. So I'm not, you know, recommending it in general, but I think it's really something to think about, which is, you know, in general, and it's appropriate to think about because really if there's anything going on at Lila Seder, I could go on and on about Lila Seder, you probably get a bad idea, but if there's anything in particular about Lila Seder, we're looking to make meaning as much as possible. That's part of what it's about. We are trying to build meaning into everything that we do. So yeah, think about it. If reclining is not saying chayrut to you, look for your chayrut as you eat. Is it understood that Magid is Haggadah? Yeah, Magid is reciting the parts of the Haggadah that are telling the story. I'm told that Professor Saul Lieberman, whenever his wife needed to go into the kitchen, would stop the Seder until she returned. Okay. There are different modes of the Seder. You can break into an additional song, or there can be an extra Dvar Torah. There are a lot of ways to accommodate different people in the Seder to make sure that everyone can be included. The requirement being there for the reading of the plagues plays into Avhin. Absolutely. They were redeemed and they're hearing what the plagues were. I still can't, every time I read that, I still can't get over that. I'm just picturing it, right? There's this woman, this poor woman is swept off her feet Seder night, and she's working Seder night. What can she do? This is her station in life. She's working Seder night, and yet she's hearing Kiddush, and she's hearing the Kor of Magid, and there's this moment where everyone at the Seder is saying, wait, stop. We have to make sure she comes in because we're about to say the Makot, and everyone needs to hear this too. You know, it's not just the pure 100% non-negotiable mitzvah parts. Everyone has to hear this too. Everyone stops so that even the maidservants are going to be able to hear this. I find it tremendously moving. And actually, I think it's back to, you know, making meaning at your Seder. What are the, think about it. What are the moments where you'd like to say to everybody who's tuning out or people who've left the table for a second, everybody stop. This is what you all have to hear. You know, let's connect. Let's be there. I agree with you about the important woman. I don't like defining the important woman or any woman who's a man. I like it with regard to God. Yeah, I hear that. And I think it's something also to think about. The discourse around shifting marriages and to what extent is a shifting marital relationship a central aspect of development of our understanding of women's relationship to mitzvot, and to what extent isn't it? I think it's a question to think about. Thank you, Judy. Noah Weinberger says, I'm really in, okay. So thank you so much, Noach, for your kind words. Okay. So thank you, everybody. And it's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure having all of you. One of the things that's tricky about this Zoom teaching is I don't even know. I was just thinking about that today, that I don't even know about who's here. I want to invite anybody who wants to be in touch. I'll put an email address here also that you can reach me. And like I said, I am hoping that we'll pick it up. I just want to need to regroup a little. We did a lot. We'll see. But I encourage you, those of you who enjoyed the series, please let Rabbi Jay know, and perhaps also some friends if we get back up to it, and also let Rabbi Jay know what you'd be interested in learning, and we'll see what we can work out. And in the meanwhile, Bezrat Hashem, we should be moving towards Geula. Tov, should be a beautiful, beautiful redemptive year. Chag Sameach to all of you coming up, and good night.